Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Daniel R. Foley, and Lisa M. Ganoza presiding. Please be seated. Case number 29145, Yogi versus Hawaii Medical Service Association. Charlie Price for appellant, Rafael Del Castillo for appellees. Argument on the merits.
Counsel ready?
Please, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. HMSA is asking this court to reverse the lower court's order denying arbitration or compelling arbitration in this case. We are asking the court to reverse and remand to the lower court with instructions that the lower court matter be stayed pending the outcome of the arbitration between Mr. Yogi and HMSA as to all the claims raised by Mr. Yogi in his complaint. Doing so would be is consistent with three overriding principles. First, it's consistent with the language of the health plan contract governing Mr. Yogi. Second, it's consistent with the public policy favoring arbitration. And third, it's consistent with the specific rule that any doubts should be resolved in favor of arbitration. Now, there are three arguments or concerns that have been raised about the enforceability of the arbitration language, the dispute resolution provisions in the health plan contract. The first is that it's optional. The second argument is that it's inconsistent with the Chapter 10 provisions which allow certain claims to go to court. And third, the argument is that the language is not specific enough to delineate the tort-type claims that are raised in Mr. Yogi's complaint as being subject to arbitration. As to the first argument, whether it's optional or not, Mr. Yogi argues that he has the option to go before the insurance commissioner whenever there is a denial of benefits with HMSA. We agree. He does have that option to go before the insurance commissioner. But if the insurance commission's jurisdiction is limited and it cannot decide all claims, including the types of claims raised in the First Circuit Court complaint, then the only available remedy or forum is arbitration. The arbitration language does not provide the courts as a third option.
But does the optional language create an ambiguity in the contract itself? In other words, if you read, someone could read that as indicating that you have two options, you can go arbitration or you go insurance commission, and if you go to the insurance commissioner, you've satisfied your appeal procedure obligations under the contract. And in this case, they did present their coverage claim to the insurance commissioner. So why wouldn't that at least create an ambiguity as to whether they satisfy their obligations?
I think there would only be an ambiguity if court was an option under the agreement. Under the dispute resolution provisions of Chapter 8, it says that the claimant must either go into arbitration or before the insurance commissioner. If they elect to go to the insurance commissioner as to certain claims, the primary claim being denial of benefits, it does not create an ambiguity where court becomes, therefore, a third option.
Right, but the agreement itself doesn't say that there are certain claims that are subject to the appeal provision that you cannot go to the insurance commissioner for. The way it's written is that you got two options. You either go to arbitration or you go to the insurance commissioner and you satisfy your obligation. You're reading into that implicit in that is that if it's a claim that is not amenable to insurance commissioner resolution, then someone reading this must know that it has to be arbitration.
Yes. And I understand your concern, and my only response to that would be to go back to the general overriding principle, which is doubt should be resolved in favor of arbitration and should not be resolved in favor of allowing the courts to be an option for this type of dispute or disagreement. As to the
counsel, if the
yes,
Yogis had chose arbitration instead of the insurance commission and didn't raise the claims in arbitration that they subsequently raised in court, would they be barred for going to court and raising it, or would they go to arbitration a second time?
There would certainly be a res judicata question as to whether that was a claim that could have been raised in the arbitration proceedings. In this case, we don't argue that there's a res judicata issue because we agree that the insurance commission jurisdiction was limited, and so the tort-type claims would not be within the jurisdiction of the insurance commission proceedings.
But does the arbitration procedure authorize the arbitrator to award damages?
Yes, just because
Is that spelled out in the agreement itself? It seems to me that the reference to the arbitration is that the arbitrator's ability to make decisions are limited to violation of law, capricious, arbitrary. It doesn't indicate that he's got the authority, or he or she has the authority to award damages. So is that inconsistent with the argument that a bad faith type claim should go to the arbitrator?
The short answer is yes, it is. But that's something that would be within the scope of the arbitrator's power. Once the claim is referred to arbitration, the arbitrator would then have the authority to determine what is his authority under that language. And Mr. Yogi would certainly be arguing that that language would not be enforceable or binding, that the dispute is subject to arbitration, and that once subject to arbitration, all remedies are available to the claimant, and those remedies would include damages. The broader language, of course, that we rely upon is the broad language at the top of the dispute resolution provision, which says that any disputes relating to coverage or anything relating to the agreement would be subject to arbitration. And no question that this provision could be rewritten to read much cleaner and better. We always fall back on the principle that arbitration should be encouraged. There is an arbitration provision here. This is a claim that arises out of a denial of benefits, and therefore, it's better to have the arbitrator resolve these disputes rather than have them in the courts.
Mr. Price, if I may, when you refer to the language at the top of Chapter 8, you say it indicates any dispute related to coverage, and when I read it, what I see is it says, if you wish to dispute a determination made by HMSA related to coverage, reimbursement, et cetera, then you have to proceed under this internal appeal procedures. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, I was paraphrasing it not as accurately as you just stated it. And in anticipation of your next question, certainly that there is specific language in this provision that specifically covers a denial of benefits. And so the question then, obviously, for the court is this dispute relating to denial of benefits also relating to coverage and any other matter related to the agreement?
I think I have a much more practical question for you, which is, if the circuit court's decision is overturned such that arbitration or your motion is granted, your motion to compel arbitration is granted, I mean, does that necessarily mean you go to arbitration under the language of the plan? Because, under the plan, would HMSA first need to make a determination of the plaintiff's claims here for bad faith, IIED, NIED, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the practical resolution would be HMSA would waive any requirement to the extent any exists to go through any internal procedure, and it could all go directly to arbitration. I think the technical way that we would view it would be the threshold question was denial of the benefits.
Right.
And that determination was already made. And therefore, because internally they'd already made the determination that there were no benefits, they logically would have also, to the extent that they had been raised, denied any claims for negligent or intentional infliction and bad faith. And so from our perspective, they have exhausted the internal procedure and they can go directly to arbitration for all of the claims relating to coverage or the agreement.
And your reading of the language is that they would go solely to arbitration because the insurance commissioner's proceeding is not the type of proceeding that would adjudicate such claims as bad faith as breach of contract.
Correct.
In other words, you would agree that the insurance commissioner's proceeding I mean, they're not, they don't have the ability under those types of proceedings to address claims for money damages, for instance.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah, the last concern that has been raised about the enforceability is, well, a couple of concerns. One is that the Chapter 10 issue about whether or not the Chapter 8 provisions are inconsistent with the Chapter 10 provisions. The Chapter 10 provisions generically say, and I'm paraphrasing, that eligibility-type claims can be resolved in court. There are not eligibility-type claims in this particular instance. There's no question that Mr. Yogi is enrolled in the plan, that dues have been paid, and that he generally has coverage under the plan. Secondly, that's consistent with the arbitration provision, because if there is an issue about whether someone's eligible or enrolled, and they're not a member of the plan, then it's consistent that if they're not a member of the plan, they're not eligible, then they wouldn't be bound by the arbitration provisions in the plan, and so it would be appropriate that those would go into court. So we read those consistently and not inconsistently, and it doesn't create ambiguity, particularly in this specific instance.
So let me see if I understand, as a practical matter, how you would, under your interpretation of the procedure, how it would work. So if in this case there's a denial of coverage, you would have the Yogis, first of all, go to the arbitrator to arbitrate the denial of coverage issue. And then, I mean, they don't have a bad faith claim unless the arbitrator finds that it was an improper denial of coverage. So they would have to upfront tell the arbitrator, take two steps. One, we want to say you improperly denied coverage, and if you find that, then give us bad faith damages?
I think it'd all be part and parcel of one single arbitration proceeding. Obviously, the threshold question would be, was the denial of benefits appropriate, and did they act in bad faith? And yes, then the arbitrator would award appropriate damages.
But those are actually separate issues, right? In other words, the question of whether the coverage was appropriately denied may not necessarily be coextensive with the question of bad faith. So you would have to open up the arbitration proceeding at the beginning and put all these claims in at the same time?
Yes. If, for example, in this instance, if Mr. Yogi elected not to go to the insurance commissioner, for example, and decided, I believe that the denial of benefits was not only incorrect, but it was just so egregious and was an act of bad faith, they could go directly to the arbitrator and say, we want you to rule the denial was incorrect. We want you to also rule it was in bad faith, and we want to be awarded damages as well.
All right, but one option clearly for the coverage issue, at least, was for the Yogis to go to the insurance commissioner.
No question, yes.
All right, so your analysis, but the insurance commissioner can't decide the bad faith issue.
Correct.
So under your procedure, they would have the option of going to the insurance commissioner, and then having won at the insurance commissioner, they would have to go and request arbitration on bad faith?
Yes.
All right, but the contract itself, when talking about what the question for the arbitrator is it shall be whether we were in violation of law, meaning HMSA, acted arbitrarily, capriciously, or in abuse of our discretion. Now, that doesn't necessarily permit the arbitrator to opine on bad faith, does it?
Does not.
All right, so someone reading this contract, when the contract itself identifies what the arbitrator's question shall be, which doesn't include bad faith, how would someone reading that contract understand that a bad faith question would logically be a decision that would have to be submitted for arbitration?
Again, not perfectly written. They would have to rely and look at, we rely on the broader language, which says that disputes relating to coverage or relating to any matter relating to this agreement is subject to arbitration. And that defines the scope. And bad faith would fall within that scope. Now, as far as what the review, the standard of review is for the arbitrator, that would be something that would be arbitrated, would be arbitrated and determined by the arbitrator whether or not that language as to the scope of his, as to the standard of his review, whether the standard of his review is enforceable or not, and whether or not he has additional powers, given the broad language. So obviously, I'm slicing it thin and making the argument that there's a distinction that the court should make between the scope and the standard of review. The scope is broad enough that the claim, the bad faith claim, would be subject to arbitration. The standard of review in this language is limited, as it says, but the arbitrator would be entitled, once it's before him, because it's within the scope, to determine whether or not that standard review was applicable and enforceable or not. My time is up.
Just one more question. HMSA wrote the contract. Who's the author of the contract?
Yes, HMSA is.
So if HMSA wanted it to be clear on its face to have the procedure you've argued, they could so write.
No question, Your Honor. My response to that simply is that the public policy in favor of arbitration is so strong that there's cases under the Federal Arbitration Act which hold that the public policy is so strong that that trumps, or the rule, the general rule that contracts should be construed against the drafter is subordinate to the general rule arbitration.
You would concede that an insured reading this contract may not have been on notice that the contract meant what you're arguing it means.
I can't concede that, Your Honor. I would simply say that the broad language saying that anything related to the agreement is subject to arbitration.
I guess if the insured was a lawyer who specialized in this area, they may have been on notice.
Right. I can't concede your point, Your Honor, but I understand what your argument is. Yes. Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. Once again, I am Rafael Del Castillo, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees. I'd like to address the questions that the court has raised, to which Mr. Price has responded on the scope. And it's important, perhaps, to revisit the Cooper case, or what I call the Cooper case, which was Hawaii Medical Association and Maxwell Cooper versus HMSA, which dealt with arbitration, was decided in 2006, actually. And one of the key determinations in the Cooper case, which, by the way, is 113 Hawaii 77, one of the key determinations in the Cooper case had to do with the scope of arbitration. And what the court found in the Cooper case in participating provider agreements was a very broad clause. And the court said on its face, this is a broad enough clause to encompass all of Dr. Cooper's claims in the class to which he is representative. But the court then said that the intention of what was to be determined was actually the governing principle here, because when in the appeal clause, what the participating provider agreement actually said was if the provider disputes a decision by HMSA, and the court found that quite narrow. In fact, it said, thus what is intended to be appealed administratively, then arbitrated are specific decisions, not broad grievances. We have a very similar case in this case. What is intended to be appealed administratively under this plan is clearly whether or not HMSA correctly denied the benefits. The medical directors to whom these appeals are made do not have the power to award damages for bad faith. They don't even visit that question. The question doesn't even come up because the medical directors, to the extent they're even trained, address medical necessity. And that comes under our statute. And they have, by the way, been repeatedly criticized for failing to document their medical necessity review. But what they do is they review the claim to determine whether or not it's actually medically necessary. They have no power, again, to award damages or anything like that. All they may do is reverse the decision that denies coverage of the benefit. So we're going up to the appeal process, from the appeal process to the insurance commissioner or the arbitrator, on the basis of what's been decided on the appeal. The question of bad faith has not been raised. The question of damages, negligent infliction of emotional distress, intentional infliction of emotional distress, none of that has been raised there. Indeed, in this particular case, part of the complaint that formed the basis for the denial was the fact that the Yogis were suffering from the delay And the insurance division certainly, the panel certainly looked at the fact that Mr. Yogi was living a nightmare. But that aside, HMSA hasn't actually provided for an arbitrable forum that can deal with the bad faith claims.
Mr. Delcasu, may I ask you this? Here we were dealing with a specific pre-authorization request, if I recall, for a particular medical procedure.
Correct.
And that was dealt with via the insurance commissioner panel, correct? What happens under your reading of the plan if a subsequent medical procedure is also required or believed to be required by Mr. Yogi's care provider, and that is denied by HMSA? Is a separate, independent internal action or appeal then initiated, or are these types of claims somehow coordinated?
Let me just repeat back to make sure I understand. We're talking about two separate applications for procedures. Say, for example, Mr. Yogi was asking for a certain kind of medication, and that was denied.
Right.
And then Mr. Yogi was also asking for the pump, the intrathecal pump.
Right.
Which he,
and they're separate in time.
And so, they're separate in time.
Right. So here you have a proceeding before the insurance commissioner that is ongoing or done. What happens then if you have a subsequent medical necessity question?
We go back to the insurance commissioner if we're denied on appeal.
So they're separate independent proceedings?
Yes, they're always treated as separate.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. It seems to me that HMSA's primary argument is the beginning of Chapter 8 identifies what must be appealed in very broad language. And I guess if you paraphrase it, is if you wish to dispute any other decision or action by HMSA or any other matter related to this agreement, you must request an appeal. All right, so as I understand the argument is you start with that as the beginning, that's the beginning. And so it would seem that if you looked at that language, any dispute or any claim or any action of HMSA that you are disputing would include conduct or actions that involve the bad faith claim. And then I guess he's combining that with the policy in favor of arbitration, and then those two things are saying, okay, well, you were given notice that it's a very broad appeal requirement, and that an arbitration is favored, so you have to arbitrate. How do we get around that, or what's your argument in terms of why that initial language is not controlling?
Well, Your Honor, the appeals process only comes up in a case in which there was a request for coverage of a benefit and it was denied. So there has to be a triggering event. And if I understand your question correctly, if there is some other claim against HMSA, not necessarily precipitated by a quest for coverage, for a request for coverage, if you just read this clause, that claim would have to go through the appeal process somehow and ultimately be channeled either to the insurance division or to arbitration. That's reading that clause too broadly because, again, as the court found in Cooper, what is intended to be submitted to the administrative process is the decision to deny coverage of a benefit. Through that narrow door go the claims. And that process is not designed to handle the types of claims that we're talking about.
You're reading the subsequent procedures that are identified in the contract to illuminate or to interpret what was meant by the initial broad language. And you're saying the procedures only focus on the acceptance or denial of coverage questions.
In fact, those subsequent procedures are what the statute 432E terms external review. And in HMSA's case, they provide also for you to be able to go to arbitration if you choose to do so. We've dealt with a number of cases where people were not real clear that they didn't have to go to arbitration. But in our statute, we've provided for the insurance division to be an alternate, actually a mandatory external review unless the petitioner opts out. So these are actually external review processes that are specifically dealt with under Section HRS 432E5, and they pertain to external review of a benefit denial. That's what starts this whole process, and that's the road we're going down. It really doesn't concern bad faith at all. And if you start with the beginning of Chapter 432E and consider the contents of that chapter, it doesn't deal with bad faith
claims. So you're saying this provision is intended to implement that statutory scheme?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's actually a statutory requirement that thou shalt provide.
In an insurance contract.
That's right, in a health insurance contract.
If the Yogis, for whatever reason, in this particular case, chose arbitration as opposed to the insurance commissioner, you would not have raised a bad faith claim at that time?
No, we would not, Your Honor.
And only if you prevailed in arbitration, then you would go to court and raise the bad faith claim.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Let me ask you this question. Under the appeal procedures as you interpret them, I take it that you would have to at least go through the procedures on the coverage question before you could sue make a bad faith claim.
Oh, no, that's exactly the point. You do not have to do that.
All right.
Because they may cover.
I see.
And as you said yourself, Your Honor, you don't necessarily have to have a denial.
So your view of it is that you don't even have to go through these coverage. You don't have to say your coverage is denied.
Sure.
You don't have to appeal that denial. You can go straight to court and say, oh, that was bad faith. They denied coverage.
Let me give you a concrete example. Let's say that a patient requires a bone marrow transplant, and there's a window in which that patient can be treated with bone marrow transplant for his leukemia. And his doctor makes application and expressly tells HMSA, you know, you've got 7 days to make this determination because otherwise the window is going to close on this guy. And HMSA doesn't make the determination in 7 days. Let's say they make it in 10, and the window is closed. They covered him. But in that case, they've damaged him completely. So we've got a bad faith claim, and we've never even gone through the appeal process.
If you went through the coverage appeal process, and the whatever which way you went, our insurance commissioner or arbitrator said that the denial of coverage was justified, would you be bound by that in a bad faith action?
No, I don't believe you'd be bound by that, Your Honor, because the determination there doesn't have to do with the elements of bad faith. It may have taken HMSA a year or two, and we've had cases in which it has. It may have taken them a year or two to make the determination.
Would you be bound by the determination that the denial of coverage was justified?
Well, if the denial of coverage was justified because it wasn't a covered benefit, we'd have a problem. But if it's a covered benefit and the treatment, the claim settlement practices constitute bad faith, you still have a bad faith claim, even though they were...
But could you relitigate the issue that was resolved by arbitration or by the insurance commissioner?
As to whether or not the coverage denial was proper?
Right.
Without having addressed that question, Your Honor, from my knowledge of res judicata, I do not believe that you could relitigate that because there would have been a final decision on that issue, one way or another. Now, on the insurance division side, of course, you've got the appeals process into the courts, and you might be litigating that question for years. And you'd still have to bring your bad faith claim before you actually do that. So you might wind up stayed in your bad faith claim. I hope that clarifies that.
I have a couple of more, I guess, technical questions for you. In the facts of this case, I take it the internal review process or appeal process was initiated sometime in January of 06, as I understand from the record. Is that like a form that HMSA has? Is there some like form that says internal appeal that they utilize? Is that anywhere in the record?
I don't necessarily recall that particular thing, but I can speak generally to that, Your Honor. what the thing starts out with is a pre-authorization form for certain things, and in this case, there was a request by the provider for pre-authorization.
So what Dr. Endicott submits is a form?
There is a document, yes, absolutely. What HMSA does is they issue a letter. If they deny the coverage, they issue a letter that says we're denying the coverage and you have appeal rights. And in their letter, they summarize what the appeal rights are.
And then there are two, there were two denials, if I recall. So they went through two rounds of denials, and then the internal appeals process started?
That's correct.
Is that the correct,
sequence? Okay. And so generally speaking, what happens is the, with respect to HMSA, the petitioner usually has to make a written request for an appeal within a certain deadline that's specified in the letter.
And it's after that internal appeals process is done that we get to the juncture of either choosing arbitration or the insurance commissioner.
That's correct, because the internal appeals process as to the coverage determination is mandatory.
Okay. And a separate sort of question, factual question, I suppose, is, does the record reflect whether Darnell Yogi is covered by the HMSA plan?
It does, and she is.
Okay.
That's why we've alleged in a complaint that she's also covered by the contract. To your point, and it's an excellent question, the insurance commissioner doesn't actually acquire jurisdiction until you've gone through the appeal process. And we've had cases rejected by the insurance commissioner when the plan just doesn't do anything.
And is that's pursuant to the statute?
That's pursuant to statute. There is the other matter, a couple of other matters that I'd just like to address quickly since I seem to have time, and that is Chapter 10, when I'm sure the court has noted in the transcript from the proceedings below that Judge McKenna actually made a particular point of the fact that HMSA was relying solely on Chapter 8 and had not presented her with Chapter 10, and she's even interlined the order. To indicate that the order pertains to Chapter 8 as opposed to the entire agreement. We raised the question about Chapter 10 because Chapter 10 actually says, and I should read it because it, HMSA's assertion that the plan expressly limits the available forms is not correct. Chapter 10 under a section, Chapter 10 is, by the way, entitled General Provisions, and under a section entitled Dues and Terms of Coverage, they say, quote, any action brought because of a claim against this coverage will be litigated in the state or federal courts, close quote. And it's extremely typical, and HMSA has not addressed this point, it's very typical for insurance plans to actually say claims against this coverage in referring to benefits or losses that the insured happens to make a claim for. In fact, HMSA is not relying on any authority for its point that this concerns eligibility under the plan. As far as the language of insurance contracts is concerned, it's quite the opposite. Claims against this coverage actually pertains to the coverage that exists under the plan and your claims for benefits there. So, we do believe that Chapter 10 inserts an additional ambiguity in terms of access to the courts. If in fact you're reading Chapter 8 and looking at whether or not arbitration is your only choice besides the insurance division, the reason that we of course raised that was because of the overall contracts. The overall contract has to be unambiguous as to the intent to arbitrate, and anybody reading this particular clause is not necessarily going to come up with the same conclusion that HMSA has, that it's limited to the insurance division or arbitration. The other thing that I wanted to point out was that I'm actually pleased to hear.
So your argument is that it creates an ambiguity, but it doesn't necessarily state that bad faith claims, I mean, it's also not clear that claims other than coverage can be brought directly to court.
Indeed. I just want to address the fact that HMSA said the forms are limited to arbitration in the insurance division because they're not. It also includes federal and state court. With respect to dispute resolution, the ambiguity in Chapter 8 is very evident. Clearly someone can be misled by the fact that...
So if I understand your argument, so your focus is on divining the intent of the parties to this contract, and your analysis is that given the appeal procedures, it makes clear that the intent was that the arbitration and the insurance commission appeal procedures apply to coverage disputes, not bad faith claims. Now, notwithstanding the broader language in the beginning. So you're trying to have us look at the contract as a whole, and then based upon the terms of the contract itself, argue that the intent of the party is revealed, and that intent is that claims such as you were bringing in this case are not covered by this appeal procedure.
Precisely, Your Honor. I mean, as you know, the first question we have to address in an arbitration is whether, in a motion to compel arbitration, is whether an agreement exists and what the terms of those of the agreement is and the intent of the parties. And so fundamentally, we've got a situation where it must be unambiguous as to the intent to submit these disputes to arbitration.
And along those lines, the scope of review by the insurance commissioner panel is the same scope of review of an arbitrator in terms of a decision.
Indeed.
Of the provider.
There's indeed.
No difference.
Well, that's not necessarily correct because the scope clause with the arbitrator, with the arbitration, also brings up the issue of breach of fiduciary duty.
So the arbitrator has a broader scope of review of a decision of the provider than the insurance commissioner and the panel.
Arguably, yes, Your Honor.
And I guess the difference between you and Mr. Price is the extent of that difference. He's arguing the scope of the arbitrator is broader.
Well, we do have a difference of opinion on, but what I'm arguing is it goes back further than that, as it did in Cooper, and we have to look at what was really intended to be submitted to the process. You can in Cooper, the arbitration clause says any and all claims, but in fact, what the court found was that it was just decisions.
Let me ask you, as someone who represents the insured, when would you choose an arbitrator? When would you choose a panel insurance commissioner? I mean, what enters into to your calculus? Why would you choose one or the other representing the insured?
We would likely choose the insurance commissioner in all cases, Your Honor, and the reason for that is that this arbitration clause contains substantial deterrence. The insured has to bear half of the cost of the arbitration. The insured also has to bear their own attorney's fees and costs. And so as an attorney, when I've got an avenue in which the petitioner will be reimbursed for attorney's fees and costs incurred and have no cost for the forum, I can't really advise them to go to arbitration. I've not, at least not come across a situation where I would do so. It's fundamentally, it doesn't make any sense. The other thing that I wanted to address here, if I can collect my thoughts on that, was the issue of res judicata. And it does appear that although there was considerable argument about res judicata before the circuit court, HMSA is backing away from the position that it would actually argue to the arbitrator that the claims should have been raised in the administrative process, and because they weren't raised there or in the insurance division, that we no longer have the right to raise the claims. But that does point out a particular feature and a particular problem with this arbitration as the way that HMSA is casting it, and that is they're saying we're not gonna do that anymore. But it appears that they do have an exhaustion argument if, in fact, it's determined that all claims have to go through that narrow gate, be submitted to a medical director, ask them, will you award damages for bad faith? Was there bad faith in this case? And if we don't raise those claims as a consumer in internal appeal, they're lost. So that's a particular problem with this whole construct And I think that, as Mr. Price says, HMSA needs to revisit the way that they've structured this, be clear about what goes to the insurance division, internal review or arbitration with respect to a decision, and if, in fact, there is mandatory arbitration for all other claims, such as punitive damages and infliction of emotional distress.
Now, I have one question on the construction. Mr. Price argued that the policy favoring arbitration trumps the contract, the common law contract construct that you construe the contract against its maker. Do you agree with that proposition?
It's hard not to agree with the proposition, but only as construed by our courts, which is, despite the strong policy favoring arbitration, we must find that there is an arbitration agreement and that the claims that the motion is attempting to compel arbitration are within the scope of the agreement. Anything else, Your Honors? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Price, before you begin, can I ask a question? I don't know the extent of your experience representing HMSA in these type of claims, but do you have any sense when the insurer chooses arbitration over the insurance commission or panel review process?
The answer is they will always go to the insurance commission for some of the reasons articulated by my colleague. And the reason is this. In terms of the background, just so you can kind of get a feel for why this language reads the way that it does, there was always the dispute resolution language requiring the insured, the HMSA member, to go to arbitration. But then in 1998, the legislature passed the Patient Bill of Rights. And part of the incentive for that statute was because, for the reasons that have been articulated, if you go to arbitration, it takes time to set up and select an arbitrator. There's an expense associated with that. And in Hawaii, typically your arbitrator tends to be a lawyer and not a medical professional. So Chapter 432E provides a form where on your panel you have medical professionals, people who have experience in the business. You can request under the statute an expedited review, so it can be a lot quicker. And then the most important thing from the consumer perspective is that the statute provides that even if you don't prevail, you can still get your attorney's fees and your expert fees paid. And there is a reported opinion where that did in fact happen, and that has been the insurance commission's practice. Unless they find that the claimant's position was in bad faith or frivolous or wasn't well taken, they typically, if you come in with an expert and offer a contrary opinion, they will give the consumer their attorney's fees and expert fees. So it's a very consumer, from the insurance company's perspective, it's a very consumer-friendly forum. So when that statute was enacted and that became a mandatory option for consumers, for insurers, the HMSA and other health plans had to go in and insert that option in their pre-existing arbitration agreements. And so that's why it reads you can go either or, and that's the genesis for that particular provision.
Thank you.
Now, as far as the language that I characterize as the standard of review for the arbitrator, where it's an abuse of discretion type standard, that language comes from when a federal district court reviews a decision by a health plan or a plan administrator under ERISA. Under ERISA, the standard is an abuse of discretion type standard. So they've taken that language and they've put that in for the standard review for the arbitrator. This is a non-ERISA plan governing Mr. Yogi. It's a governmental plan.
Is there a different standard for the insurance commissioner? In other words, why? So you're saying that if an arbitrator decides the coverage question, the HMSA wins unless they find it's an abuse of discretion?
No, and just to continue my line of thought, sorry, there is that the standard of review has been challenged, and in arbitrations, arbitrators have held, well, that's an ERISA standard that does not apply in a non-ERISA case, and I am not bound by that standard. The insurance commissioner is not bound by that standard as well. So the history is that language has been determined to be unenforceable in terms of the standard review. The insurance commissioner has taken the position that that language is unenforceable, and health plans contracts have to be approved before they're put in place in the marketplace. And current health plans, my understanding is, current health plans, because of the insurance commissioner's directive, do not include that language. But that's the genesis for that abuse of discretion type language. So there would be, I'm not going to concede it, but there would be a viable argument in the arbitration that could be made by Mr. Yogi to the arbitrator, assuming the court would agree that the scope included a bad faith type claim, that the arbitrator is not bound by that standard and he can award all kinds of relief as well as damages, and he's not held to an abuse of discretion standard. I think the key thing on this case is whether or not the court is going to agree or not with the idea that if an arbitration provision is not perfectly written, and if there is some room for doubt, whether or not arbitration should be compelled or not. And I think that comes down to whether the court will decide and agree that the public policy favoring arbitration is so compelling that it trumps the general rule that ambiguity should be resolved against the drafter. And if the court agrees with that, and there are California cases that have held under the Federal Arbitration Act that have stated that in effect, that the general rule that contracts should be construed against the drafter does not necessarily apply in an arbitration context because the courts favor arbitration so much. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.
All rise. Court is now in recess.